Welcome. Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll be exploring the cultures of consciousness today, virtual reality, novelty waves. It's good stuff. I first met our guest today, Bruce Dahmer, back in the day, in the 90s, the heady days of virtual reality and cyberspace, which, if you didn't go through them, probably sound kind of dorky. But let me tell you, it was exciting. With the internet kind of moving into public consciousness, the birth of the World Wide Web, the popularity of cyberpunk science fiction from the late 1980s, the psychedelic electronic music revival of the early 1990s, all of these things fed into a very interesting period that's not really acknowledged or talked about too much. And in that environment where I first came across Bruce's work, and he's one of those characters that could only exist in the Bay Area. He dresses like a magnificent hippie with fabulous, Renaissance freak costumes that he designs himself, and yet he manages to, do gigs for NASA and high-end corporations about space exploration and artificial life and all this amazing, wonderful stuff. But we'll talk about the various pies he's got fingers in a second. I want to bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dahu. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. It sounded like the theme music was coming back there for a second.
Oh, yeah. It follows me around.
You're in the grocery store, you're like, oh, man. Have you ever done, like, a virtual reality thing, like with the goggles or the hand and flying through virtual spaces and stuff?
I totally have never done that, but I did. I had my uncle was working with a lot of virtual reality stuff, and I did get invitations to do it. He was actually friends with William Gibson, and he was, from the Bay Area too, and was working on artificial intelligence, and then he was in all that crazy stuff. So I only know about it vicariously through my uncle.
Yeah, that's good. He's still got some interesting. Interesting connections there. I mean,
yeah.
You had a little taste of that crazy 90s world as well, though.
Yes, I read Snow Crash and the whole thing.
I know. It's amazing how much that these ideas sort of drifted between science fiction and imagined possibility and back into science fiction, and it's very rich stuff. But with that, let's bring on Bruce Dahmer. Bruce, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hello, Eric.
Hey, man. Good to hear you. Where are you? You're calling from, you're at a conference or something?
I'm in beautiful Ojai, California. Down in Southern California. The place where the film Lost Horizon was shot, the Shangri-La.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I mean, one of the nice things about the Ojai Valley is it's one of the only sort of east-west transverse valleys on the whole sort of, North American coastline, which is generally very north-south. So you get this very interesting, beautiful light when the sun goes down, because the sunset light radiates through the whole back of the valley as you head towards the desert. It's a really extraordinary place. A lot of mystical stuff went down there.
It's called the pink moment, when the Topatopa cliffs are glowing with that radiant, marine layer infused pink light.
The pink light. Always be aware of the pink light. So, there's so many places to start, but just because we were talking about virtual worlds, and I was just today, I was actually reading a really excellent book about science fiction. I mean, it was led by a literary critic who's kind of trying to come up with a different theory of what science fiction is. And that, it was pretty interesting, idea of that what happens with science fiction is that it creates ways to try to describe objects that are real objects, real conceptual objects, but they're really hard to imagine. So it has to go through all of these different special sort of techniques in order to sort of embody this, like an idea like, you know, the global network of consciousness. You know, you're like, what is that? That's like pretty, that's not like imagining, you know, a revolver or a box of cereal. You know, I can do that one. And in a book, you can just say, a box of cereal was on the table. But you can't just say, the network's global mind was on the table. You're like, what? That doesn't work. You know, you have to, like, build up to all this stuff. Anyway, so she was talking about all these forms of cognitive estrangement and these interesting kinds of objects. But she talked about cyberspace, and she talked about how this idea developed in a fictional world, and William Gibson coins the phrase. He imagines this three-dimensional interactive environment that, you know, there's a few precedents for in science fiction, but not really, not very much. It was a genuinely novel vision. And then, you know, as the 90s roll, early 90s roll along, it sort of becomes the way of thinking about this actual space that's being developed. And I know you were right in the heart of all that, so I'm just kind of curious about your story, how you got into the virtual world stuff and the kind of things you were up to there back in the day.
Well, I think as a kid, I always had this 3D mind. I was always piloting my spacecraft in the fleet and zooming into planets. I did in the 70s, you know, while being very bored at school, I would draw planetscapes, civilizations, overhead maps that would grow over time. So I was a total sucker for this stuff. And I, too, read Snow Crash. And in the early 90s, I was living in Prague building leading a team building 2D software, you know, Windows and icons kind of thing. And then I just one day thought, you know what? This World Wide Web thing is coming. I'd seen it in 1993, the Mosaic interface. I thought, that's not so interesting, because cyberspace, that's an interface. Cyberspace is one day going to be a place, and it's going to have a face on it. And so I bought a van, and I drove all around North America looking for anybody working on this thing. And I found groups at Microsoft, universities, hackers. I said, there is a vision, and this thing is coming. And in 94, located in the Auguste Bay Area, living in the Redwood Forest, and set up a couple of organizations and started to build a social network and an organization that eventually we held 6 or 7 conferences on this thing, and I wrote a book about it. You know, so as it was, before it came alive, we had a big brainstorming session. We said, if there were avatars, if there were multiplayer games or large landscapes, what would they be? And this brainstorming document sort of informed everything. And as these environments started popping up in 1995-96, we got all those people together, and we got them in the same conferences and in the same experiments and helped power the medium up.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very exciting notion, and even just the whole idea of avatars, which is the name of your book and your world, and the kind of you know, all the creative thinking about identity and all this kind of stuff. And it must be very interesting. I mean, it's for me to look back. I mean, I was not involved in producing this stuff. I was like a journalist and writing about these things, you know, tracking them. But when I look back at it now, where it's like simultaneously, you're like, the vision came true. Because you look at Second Life, you look at World of Warcraft, you look at all the social networking and the icons and blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, I go, the vision did not come true. There's something missing. And I'm really curious. Yeah. I mean, you're an upbeat guy, but you also have you know what's going down on this, you know, somewhat tortured planet. How do you compare, like, how things have developed in virtual reality with social networks and 3D spaces? You know, in comparison to where you saw the potential when you first saw this stuff on the horizon.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, and this goes back to the birth of any new medium. So in the beginning of radio, if people thought radio was going to be a two-way transmission thing where you could teach classes between towns. And the beginning of automobiles, so everyone built their own. There were 500 automobile manufacturers in like 1910 or 15, and they had steering wheels on one side or the other and different ideas of what engines should do. And so in the mid-90s, when the explosion of virtual worlds happened, what happens is you get everyone experimenting, And then they fill the niches. They figure out what the affordances are, and they invent the medium. And then the second round, which started with Second Life and there, and they just kind of ape to what was done before. There was very little innovation in the second round virtual world. It just got a little bit more widely used. And, of course, multiplayer gaming got much more widely used than social virtual worlds. I think we're coming to a time, there's this now this period of this interregnum period where we're going to see everything come into some grand convergence. I'll give you an example. You know, if you went to the movies in 1905, you'd be watching the Keystone Cops and black and white, you know, 20-minute shorts with no sound. And you think, well, this is not a realization of a dream. I can go and watch live theater and have something much more emotive. But if you, by the time you came to 1936, you know, basically you had color, you had stereo, you had incredible experience. So it just took that long because the business grew up, the studio system, the star system, promotion, you know, the production value, storytelling, all came. And virtual worlds are in this interregnum period. And I think maybe augmented reality interfaces, you know, direct retinal displays, the merging of geo data with the virtual world. A great example from science fiction is Werner Vinge's Rainbow Damned, which is set in the late 2020s, and it's in a world of augmented reality, and everyone uses this Epiphany system. And if you read that, you say, wow, that's the vision for virtual worlds. You know,
can you
see a little bit of... Go ahead, Rick.
Oh, just a little bit about augmented reality. I mean, people are talking about it now, but it's one of those things that's still a little unclear, I think. You know, how do you see that and that technology, and how do you see it taking some of the virtual world's ideas forward, in fact, maybe even improving on some of the problems that were in some of the original conceptions?
Well, for example, in our work with NASA, so after I was working in the social virtual world space in around 1999, when really the early adopter phase was ending, we decided to take virtual worlds into new spaces, and one of them was outer space. So we took it to NASA and said, these can be powerful tools for telepresence on other planets, for designing the next modules going to the space station, for figuring out how to land on asteroids and things like that. And so for 10 years, they hired my team, and we built about 25 projects in virtual worlds, with physics and, you know, really kind of more advanced stuff. And one of the things we realized was, you know, if astronauts on the space station or astronauts that are outside and, you know, in their spaces doing construction, doing maintenance, they live in this totally augmented world. You know, on their helmets are projected, you know, the visions of the circuit diagrams or the communications. They live in a completely built environment. But they were kind of a canary in the mine in a way for, you know, your kids or your kids' kids will be wearing something like Sergey Brin was sporting last week, these kind of Google goggles. But they'll be much more subtle. And instead of looking down at their iPhone, they'll probably just look out at the world and see game characters walking down the street, you know, the weather projected onto the clouds. Is this cloud going to drop rain on me? And it would be helpful to know at Burning Man if that was going to happen. Or I can look through this mountain and I can see that my buddy's on a real tripped out sport bike in the next valley, because I can see his bike in the virtual thing, and I can go over there and I'm going to ride my bike with him.
Or more realistically, you'll just kind of look around and see porn everywhere.
Of course, you'll stare at your own body, and you'll say, oh, my God, I've got a nodule forming in my spleen or something. frightening.
Well, what do you think, you know, since obviously something like this is coming, and there will be enough adoption that it will become a real social force, and it will obviously really, you know, if you think, you know, iPhones have already had an impact on how people move through space and time and, you know, engage with information. And you actually, I'm just kind of turning the world itself into a kind of site for information processing about what's happening. I mean, obviously, augmented reality is a whole other order. What do you think that we've learned or that you've learned looking at what happened with virtual worlds and some of your, you know, more utopian ideas and just how things kind of developed commercially and culturally? What do you think are some things that really should be a high priority in terms of thinking about augmented reality and the way in which it will also, you know, allow us to further the exploration of virtual worlds?
I think that, and this is actually goes back to conversations that I had with Terrence McKenna and he had with others. One of the concerns that he expressed, which I share, is that if you go into virtual worlds and the design of the world is just this pedantic, cheesy, lowest common denominator space, which in the case of a lot of Second Life worlds, it kind of is. I mean, everybody's prancing around in the skinniest, most flowing avatar they can find, and so there's no, you know, there's no sense of realness, and then there's the street spaces or hillsides or inside the buildings. It's quite uninspired. You know, it's like going to a local corner mall. And so, in a sense, imagination needs to be infused in these spaces. And new modes. I mean, why do you need to be in a body? Why can't you be a multi-sensory, you know, being? Why can't you experience
something
new? Well,
but this, to me, I mean, this addresses a really kind of pertinent thing with the virtual reality business. And I don't know if you read any of those articles, like with the Korean couple that let their own baby kind of like fall into disrepair while they were taking care of the virtual baby. And these kind of things where, as a result of living in these imagination virtual worlds, people's physical bodies can fall into extraordinary disrepair. Like, as you mentioned, in their avatars, people will pick these very unrealistic kind of, you know, thin, flowy, elfy people. But then in reality, many of them have serious health issues that they are not confronting and then, you know, participate in these virtual worlds. I mean, what do you think some of the ramifications of that are? Like, how do we have a good, healthy relationship with the imagination virtual world while still kind of maintaining our meat suits?
Yeah, that's the tough one. And, of course, it's DeMasio at USC, the well-known brain researcher. What they have found is that if you're using virtual worlds, they're using just texting or tweeting or any kind of interface where you're constantly getting interrupts. It's shooting cortisol into your system, so you get a high from this kind of a stimulus, and it comes back to rapid eye movement. If you were a primate on the plains of Africa and you were walking along and suddenly your eyes move rapidly, it's usually because there's prey or you're a prey. And so the cortisol system kicks in and the adrenaline system kicks in. Now, over time, what that means is you start having adrenal fatigue, and many adults have this, and probably many younger people, but you end up crashing another system, which is you start living in the short-term high-speed brain, and you stop living in the somatic brain, which is associated with memory, emotion, feeling, empathy, and you stop being able to access as easily those things because you're constantly in the stimulus response. It's like you're Pavlov's dog. So that is the bigger issue, the big brain experiment that is carried out now on 2 billion people constantly that is changing us. And the earlier you start as a child, the more you're going to have this, you know, biochemical reprogramming, structural reprogramming from an early age. And that's the big news. That's the big untold story that's going to affect the 21st century more than anything.
So how do you see that changing the way that, I mean, I can think of some things sort of anecdotally, but how do you see the way that shift in sort of brain response and even kind of the location, you know, if you imagine the brain, you know, as a modular system, which it is, and the mind is a modular system, that you're bringing forward certain kinds of responses to the environment, certain kinds of, adrenally informed intensities. How does that start to do you see signs of that around? What does it look like? What do you see as an indice of this kind of shift?
it's fairly huge. You know, what you see is the ordinary person, their attention span, you know, before they go and look at their phone, or their ability to kind of be present is I think, in rapid decline for a lot of people. I find this in myself. I mean, geez, you know, if in a day you take out your phone and look at it 150 times, that chops up your attention so that other things can't get in. And there's an opportunity cost there. You think you're kind of living, but you're starting now to miss things. So you're missing when you're walking in the park and you're looking at your phone. The other night I was looking at my phone in the middle of the night and I stepped on my cat.
So, oh, man.
Yeah, oh, man. And so you think it was 1 billion or 2 billion people now doing this massive, massive distraction, unbelievable distraction. So does Mother Nature come conspiring? You know, is there an alien force trying to distract us with all these devices, or are we just sort of suckering into this? The cost is going to be fairly high, I think. It's going to be in human relationships, in the ability to create art, in the ability to do deep thinking in philosophy or studying history, solving hard problems in science. I mean, I'm working on basically on the origin of life. And in order to work on the origin of life problem, which is one of the hardest problems in science, 10, you know, years ago, I turned off all broadcast media. I really don't look at the news because I actually have to sit and read a lot of books. And this is, again, when we talk about Terence McKenna, they don't, you know, if a person was born today, would they read 10,000 books by the time they were 25 and have infused all that knowledge and then be able to relate to all those things? I doubt whether there will be many people that will be born.
Just to clarify, reading in a book, that eye movement involved in reading is not the same rapid eye movement as involved with some of the, like, technological stuff. Is that correct?
That's correct. And, in fact, the whole memory, there's a professor at University of Colorado that characterized reading on a screen has a lot lower retention, memory retention than reading on paper. Now, of course, on Kindles and things, I haven't really looked at that. But if you're reading something on screen and then you flip over to your email for a second, your retention and your understanding and processing is interrupted. And you're really... Now, let's give you a funny example of this. So NASA, over 10 years... Now, this is 10 years. 1961 to, like, 1970, NASA built, designed, built, and flew three different flight systems, and then they got to the moon. Three different architectures. And they designed the lunar lander by locking people up in a room and with whiteboards or blackboards, and all those people came up with this, you know, in a few days, this beautiful design, and they all had a common mental model, and they circulated the design. And everybody knew how the lunar lander was going to work. In 25 years since NASA decided they got to replace the space shuttle, they have not come up and built a complete any kind of a replacement. So now they're doing, you know, the commercial guys like SpaceX will do it for them. And it's like I asked the people there. I know people who walked on the moon. There's a surviving Apollo astronaut. Some people were in the program, and they said, "We do not have the massive distractions that the average officer or scientist or engineer has today. We didn't have email in the 60s, so man, could we really think things through? We really could solve things. We could ponder things for a month and come up with the best way to do a lunar buggy or something." And so,
yeah, it's true. It's not even that they're just, you know, they have phones and they're talking to their wives or whatever. It's that the very nature of science and the way that it's reproduced through the institution and the way that it relates to information and how it relates to, you know, the internet and databases, it overwhelms scientists in a way that didn't happen as much, you know, in the era that you're that you're talking about. So even the nature of science has shifted in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of more and more of the problems that people are dealing with are just these, like, massive informational overload problems and just trying to figure out how you can, you know, correlate information that's already there. I mean, it's totally clear that there are solutions to scores of problems that are buried away in the matrix, but all they require is some savvy correlation. Well, this guy figured this one thing out about DNA replicators over here, and this guy figured out this one thing about photon emissions over here, and if you could somehow bring it together, but that requires a certain kind of mind, and then that leads to this question of, like, are we in this sort of bottleneck where the only way forward is to, like, you know, become even more intimately involved with the machine and create these sort of mind-machine, connections that will enable some of these qualities of the human mind that are sort of overwhelmed at this moment to actually kind of regain some ability, but at the same time to sort of be using the massive data munching capacities of machines to kind of augment that process. Do you see that coming?
I can tell you, I just turned 50, and doesn't feel like it, but I took on this project of defining how to build a machine that synthesizes real chemical experiments with computers, massively parallel grid computers, to work on trying to get a chemical solution closer and closer and closer to a prebiotic state where you could actually see biological activity. And this would be before life is observed, but things would be happening in them that are rich and suggestive that if you ran the experiment for another million years, which nature needs, you would see the emergence of a living molecular machine. And this is called the Evolution Grid Project, or the EVO Grid, and it's what I did my PhD work on. And what I'm doing now is putting together a book with 35 other authors of all the different fields you would need to do this. And it's complexity theory, and it's the design of imaging chemicals, and it's the complex polymerization techniques, and it's robotic chemistry, combinatorial chemistry.
Now, if only you can get each of the contributing authors to read everybody's essays and not just their own, maybe that we can make some headway.
And that's the goal, but the problem is, as Eric is pointing out, is there's so much information. I know it's going to fill my brain completely up to bursting in the next year, but I don't know of any system, other than a human being and a crazy weird one like me that's going to take this on, of doing the correlation to come up with something new that's across fields. I think you probably need to get away from specialists. You need generalists to do this. And the human brain's the only thing, the only game in town. But then you're really producing one result, and you hope that people read the book, and the book may not be read by anybody, because there's so many books and there's so many publications, and everyone's supposed to produce more and more publications. So, yeah, it, for the both of you, I mean, how does humanity make progress on key problems in this milieu?
Well, let's explain a little bit more about what the EVO Grid is. It sounds like it's a little bit like the SETI at Home project, where you're using massive parallel computers to simulate the enormous amount of time and combinatory possibility that would have to exist for something like life to emerge out of a whole bunch of different kinds of primordial soups. Is that something like that?
It's exactly right, Eric, and in fact, during a big conference in France last summer, I was deeply depressed because I was a week away from defending the PhD thesis, in which we had done hundreds of thousands of small volume chemical simulations in computers. And we found, one of the results was that it's just far beyond the capacity of computers to do this stuff. And so I was depressed, sitting on a park bench and with another researcher, and then popped into my head with this idea of, no, let the molecules simulate themselves. Do small volume chemical experiments and roboticize them. So this would be like SETI at Home. We call this the chemo grid for chemicals. And you would be able to build your own microfluidic array at home, or your own maker faire kind of thing, that as long as you injected the right starting things and you did the right analysis and imaged it, it would start more experiments, you know, at a big lab somewhere, which would start another set of 500 experiments somewhere else. And you just pass the hot potato of the results on between these grids until, you know, that hot potato is generating a richer and richer soup, and somebody sees something or a computer system rings a bell and says, I've seen dividing protocells that divided again. And that's bingo.
So are the individual units, are they all just simulated, or are people actually doing chemical experiments?
Real chemistry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's where it's gone, because the computers in my lifetime, probably in 50 years, there will not be fast enough computers to do this stuff. And because of the von Neumann architecture, I went back to the Institute for Advanced Study and went through Oppenheimer and von Neumann's papers from the 40s and 50s to figure out how they came up with the design of the computer that we all use today. And, you know, there's some notes in that file that say, this is just contingent architecture. There are much better ways to do computing, but here it is. At least it works. And we're still stuck with that. And the computers we use today are in opposition to the very concept of being able to model natural systems. This is where, you know, people, science fiction ideas like the singularity and whatnot completely break down. I've discovered the horrible truth that digital computation is based on such a flimsy and weak architecture that we cannot go very far with it the way that it currently works.
Wow, that's some fascinating stuff. I want to talk to more about that, but we're going to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Du. We're talking to Bruce Dahmer, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back. This is Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Bruce Dahmer about making life possible. And, of course, you know, one of the things that I think always comes up, as well it should, is the whole ethical situation with getting closer to being able to technologically, chemically, biologically reproduce these kind of situations. You know, I think it's very ironic that you got started on this path in Prague, because, of course, that's the spot where Rabbi Loew made the golem, you know, in man's attempt to create life and become as God. You know, and that, of course, spurred the whole Frankenstein situation. And, you know, as much as there are always these attempts, you know, there's the Miller-Urey experiment, people are always trying to kind of get to this thing, to have life get created for man to kind of take on that godlike quality. And I was just wondering if you get confronted with those ethical issues, if they come up in yourself, you know, do you think about, like, Eric Drexler's ramifications of, like, the great goo that could get created in our attempts to do this, or how has that kind of come up in your world dealing with this stuff?
Yeah, thanks, Maja. These are good questions. By the way, my last name is pronounced Dahmer.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Dahmer.
So think Daimler Benz and take the L out, and you have me. I'm a Honda more than a Daimler Benz. Interestingly enough, yeah, in the project that is now, it's become a book. It was a PhD thesis. It was a running system at UC San Diego, the computer part, and now the book. We have two philosophers writing for this, and I will be recruiting somebody from the creationist side of the fence from a previous book project who showed a great interest in this origin of life experiment. And I said, you know, you believe that, you know, God created life, and in fact, If this Genesis engine, as we're calling it, that's sort of the popular name for these things that I'm trying to put out there, a controversial name, if a Genesis engine works and you have something that looks like it could become a living system, and I want to clarify, what you're going to get out of a machine like this, out of an experiment, you're not going to get a living system. You're going to get something that is pre-biotic, But right. it chemically, there's all kinds of neat things happening, like the little bubbles are dividing and dividing again. They're eternal. But truthfully, you know, if life began on Earth that way, it was very, very fragile in the beginning. I'll give you an example of life as it could have been 3.9 billion years ago, would have been very, very frail, little silvery lipid vesicles with a bunch of molecules inside. It just barely learned or just barely evolved how to do the metabolism thing, how to get rid of waste and maybe code a little information of when the next division's going to happen. That kind of molecular machine is as complex compared to an E. coli bacteria, one of the smallest cell, individual living things. That's like a rubber ducky compared to the Queen Mary, sitting alongside the Queen Mary in terms of the machinery. So that rubber ducky, or that, you know, inflated boat or whatever you would see, took, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of years to ratchet itself up through Darwinian natural selection to become a Queen Mary-like thing. And that's one of the most awe-inspiring processes in the universe. But when we make something from scratch, and we're not talking about Craig Venter simply, you know, injecting new parts into an existing cell. He's just doing biohacking
right.
of a giant machine. When you do life from scratch, you end up with something that's so frail and so, it's just barely there. It's like a wisp. And if you dumped it down the sink, it'd be gone. And existing biology would come and eat it all up. It would, in fact, if the bacteria would probably come alongside and suck them up because it was like, oh, there's some food value in these things, and they'd be gone.
Well, and that's because you can even see this happening in, like, protein strands, right? I mean, there's the mad cow disease thing where it doesn't even have to be bacteria. You can even have a chain of proteins that can take on, like, kind of these lifelike things as well. And those, obviously, protein would be nutrients for some. If there was some biological thing around, it would just eat the protein strand. But
yeah.
Even on that little level, they can assemble to kind of create something.
And going to the Eric Drexler and the Grey Goo crowd, the people that are on I've become a convert since I stopped hanging out with artificial life and artificial intelligence and all these people in robotics and whatnot, and I started hanging out with the people in biochemistry and origin of life. I say, you know what? The people who are on the engineering side, on the software side, are astoundingly uninformed as to how nature works.
Yeah.
And they're astoundingly naive and almost childlike naivete because their programming tool set that they use is so limited, and their environments, their virtual worlds are so limited compared to a drop of water with a living thing in it. And so they live in a virtual reality of their own, and they believe that all things are possible, and yet I think it's a grand delusion. So things like, you know, like Ray Kurzweil's prognostications and, you know, fears, you know, from science fiction, we can barely keep an automobile running for more than a certain period of time, or the Internet itself is a constant handwork of maintaining and fixing crash servers and restarting services and stuff like that. Technology, human technology, is very, very fragile, very frail, and can't really do much autonomously. You know, NASA's rovers on Mars, they, instead of attempting to make an autonomous rover that could figure out its own trajectory and do its own sampling and do its own health monitoring, the farthest they've got is that the Mars rovers can be programmed to drive for, say, 30 meters. If they go up on a rock, they'll stop because the attitude has changed. But it's really human beings that are infused in operating those rovers every day and putting their intelligence into the rovers that made those missions successful. It's not autonomy.
Well, this is really a powerful message to hear, you know, especially for those of us who, you know, are a little bit more on the sidelines, you know, watching some of the singularity rhetoric and really feeling like this sense of this kind of naivete, and that there's just a, once you you know, once you just create the concept of a simulation, and then you meld it with the concept of a, you know, a kind of quantum computer, you go, well, I guess that could do anything, you know, and maybe it could with farther enough down the line. But, you know, hearing you, someone who's, you know, been increasingly immersed in the real biochemistry of the situation, make that, you know, pronouncement, especially given your background and the people that we've, you know, come up reading and being inspired by, you know, it's a really, really significant thing. I mean, it really goes down to, you know, in so many ways and in so many levels, we are, you know, human beings right now are just, you know, alienated from the you know, biological reality. And, you know, you can talk about that on a cultural level, you can talk about that in terms of resources, but, you know, even on this sort of scientific, technological, intellectual level where people are really trying to imagine the future, there's this huge gap, you know. And I'm curious how you see that. Is that changing? What can happen to help that change? How do we, in a way, we kind of have, if you see that reality, there's sort of an obligation to disabuse people of these naive, technological, Promethean ideas, because they're not going to work. And if you go too far forward with these weak concepts, you might actually create some really, really problematic situations. So how do you see the kind of technological evolutionary shift that needs to happen?
Yeah, we are surrounded by all kinds of, I call it the nonsense noosphere. And the nonsense noosphere is ever expanding. Now, we talked about Isaac Asimov. The only thing bigger than the universe was Isaac Asimov's ego or something. But the nonsense noosphere of conspiracy theories and weird beliefs and you know, extropianism and transhumanism and you know, apocalyptic thinking, the nonsense noosphere is alive and well and pumped up. It's like it's on steroids right now, and Facebook helps and the net helps and everything. And is it a planetary ego that is just having its day in the sun, or what is it? But it's very, very difficult to sort of cut through this noosphere, because it's all based on belief. And if people sort of grow up in a system where they're overwhelmed with information and story, and they will go with something because it feels good.
I would disagree a little bit, because some of these kind of conspiracy theories and these fear-based propaganda, which I agree with you completely, is basically what it is. Some of these cautionary tales against mankind investigating these matters are very, very old. You know, cautionary tales of man not trying to do this. I mean, that goes back to Babylon. That goes back to the Vedas. Like, there are these kind of stories forbidding certain investigations. So, I mean, although I do agree that a lot of these things get out of control on that level, and I think it's very awesome that you said, like, this is something that is fragile and not, doesn't have the capacity to take on, you know, what a lot of people are implicating, but you do have to acknowledge that there have been stories saying, like, don't do this and try and be like God that date back way far into our history.
Oh, yeah, and you know, the good news about this time we're in the 21st century is we really have a huge amount of human beings that are highly informed, who are actually working on serious problems and finding solutions, who are doing seriously good art, great music. I mean, it's actually the noise of the nonsense noosphere is not drowning out or crushing that effort. That effort is going along.
Right.
And that's the good news. The bad news is the wasted minds. You know, I'll meet people who have believed in singularities and transhumanism and this and that, and I'll say, you know, you can spend the next 10 years in this belief system, and I guarantee you, you know, you'll be in your 40s and you'll see none of this happening. Do you really want to risk your life? Because it's a fantasy. It's science fiction fantasy. And a couple of the people that I've spent a lot of time with have said, you know, you saved me. You pulled me out of this nosedive. I realized it was almost like a cultish thing. I would go to these meetings, and when I see, there's a good example. I didn't do this, but this fellow who fell into the Raelian cult that believed the pyramids were built by, you know, extraterrestrials. And so he went to Egypt. This was about 20 years ago. Went to Egypt, and there was a dig. There was a, you know, antiquities project going on at the University of Cairo, and he went in and he watched them. He got so fascinated with the reality of what they were uncovering. They uncovered a bakery, which was part of the city of artisans and engineers that lived to build, you know, and it was extremely beautifully organized. So he quit the cult, got a PhD in archaeology, and he went back and he's been working on the Giza Plateau ever since. And he said the true story of how the pyramids were made is so much more compelling than any imaginary tale that someone cooks up just to sell out a seminar.
Right.
So it's the wasted minds that are the big loss on this.
Well, it's a funny thing, and I think that a lot of the singularity crowd, they ascribe to a certain kind of rationalism, certain kind of faith in, you know, enlightenment reason, that they've kind of protected themselves from the recognition that anybody from the, or a lot of people from the outside can totally see that there's something, you know, profoundly religious and sectarian and quote unquote cult-like in aspects of that worldview. I mean, as someone who studies, you know, comparative religion, you know, sociologically, intellectually, you know, whatever, it's like, it's just so obvious. You're just like, oh, you guys, I mean, you're just running through this process with, you know, different lingo, a different image of the kind of millennial apocalypse, but, you know, it's pretty obvious, but because it runs on a certain kind of reason or idea of reason, in a way they're sort of, you know, protected from that observation. But, you know, before answering that, I just wanted to let you know that we got about 10 minutes left, and we haven't even talked about Terrence McKenna, which is, again, one of the things that, you know, that you and I have hooked up over in the past, and I know you've done a lot to kind of keep his name out there and to, you know, work on archiving materials and work on, you know, video archives and you know, having conferences, talks at Burning Man, stuff on podcasts. So it's been important to you, even though you're very busy, got a lot of stuff to do, important stuff on your plate, to kind of keep Terrence in the mix. And I just want to give you the opportunity to talk about why, like what it was about meeting him and his ideas and, you know, really how he informs you as you ask these kinds of questions that we've been talking about today.
Well, interestingly, with Terrence, and I knew him in the 90s, you know, he passed away in 2000, we traded places. He helped me to explore some of his worlds, and I helped him learn about the worlds of cyberspace. And we were sort of comparing, you know, what can the mind render? What realities or what do you, you know, virtual realities can the mind render, but that, can they be matched at all to the vividness of the realities that technology renders? Those are two technologies doing the same thing. So that was fascinating. And then we were planning a workshop at ESSEL, and then the poor fellow up and got himself a terrible condition and passed away. And so I didn't really think about him for about 4 or 5 years. And then one night I sat up in bed, and, you know, you always sit bolt upright in bed when you have powerful ideas. And the words in my head were, "Terrence, you left too soon. I'm bringing you back." And then shortly thereafter, a fire raged through the office, the in-town office of Esalen Institute, and destroyed all his papers, all his massive collection of books, all chemical books and whatnot. And I called up my friend Lorenzo Haggerty, who runs the Psychedelic Salon podcast, and said, "Terrence is gone. His physical archives is gone." And I was in the middle of trying to handle Timothy Leary's physical archive at the time. "So Terrence will only exist in cyberspace. So put out a call and tell people to send in their cassette tapes, recordings," and gradually over 5 years we put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And now there's a big corpus of his talks. So it allowed me to study the man. And then I started interviewing people who knew him, family members, a lot of help from his brother Dennis on this, and discovering the totality of Terrence. You know, who was he? Good, bad, and brilliant, and ugly, and this and that. There were, with Timothy Leary, I mean, his life was a kind of a train wreck. He was a high dancer. He was brilliant, but it was an astonishingly chaotic trajectory through life. And with Terrence, he was more of a thinker and a reader and a synthesizer. And so it's a conundrum. So by this fall, I recognized I had this huge load of insight into Terrence, and we're doing a program all this year called Terrence McKenna Beyond 2012. We did one in L.A., Esalen's coming up in June, Burning Man, and a couple more events. And I was like, how can you summarize this man's life? How can you make sense? Because he shouldn't be worshipped as a saint, but he should be appreciated as a brilliant, insightful storyteller, synthesizer, historian, scholar of that sort. And I know, Eric, you did an absolutely beautiful job in the final interview with Terrence in late 1999. And it's a conundrum, but it's also an interesting challenge of how to, in 2 hours or two days on a weekend, how to wrap up this man's legacy and say what is valuable to carry forward, what are lessons, what were just cockamamie ideas, what are the most entertaining things that he uttered. Real challenge.
No, it's an interesting one. I've thought a lot about this. I'm looking forward to Dennis's autobiography story of his life with Terrence very much, because he occupies such an odd place. You know, I mean, you were talking before in comparing him to Leary, and if like Leary was the expansive, visible, electric, neon, high wire dancer. There was something about Terrence that was very close to the ground, that was very mushroom-like, kind of a little bit in the shadows, sending out lots of feelers, definitely influencing a lot of people for over a very important period of time, but also a little bit veiled from the big picture. I mean, he had his moments in the sun when, he got big magazine articles about him, et cetera, et cetera. But he never really had that big kind of major media impact for an extended period of time. Instead, he was like influencing the rave culture, which itself was already kind of a marginal underground that a lot of people went through, and they pick stuff up, but then they go on to live other lives and things like that. And it's really interesting, because it's like I have the same impulse of like, it's just really important that people for whom Terrence would be important to have the opportunity to be exposed to him and his voice in particular, and the way that he synthesized information on the fly, and his humor and his darkness and the complexity of his character. And yet it's not altogether clear how that happens, other than just making sure the information is out there so that people who are going to find it, and however they find it, are able to continue to propagate it. Like, in some ways it also wants a little bit of obscurity. You know, it's not going to be like, the way people think about, Allen Ginsberg now. It's just like, he's just an icon. You know, he's going to be on the Apple ad. But you're never going to have Terrence on the Apple ad. You know what I mean? It's a little bit. What's that?
We'll never see him on Think Different.
Exactly. You know, there's just a little something, which I think is really positive, but it makes a challenge for precisely what you're doing. So I
did in the end, Eric, actually, after listening to your interviews again, I was prepared, and I interviewed a lot of different people. I told Dennis, there's so much stuff here, I can't even begin to think about it. And there was some dark side stuff, too. And Dennis wrote back and said, I know, it, and I'm writing the book, and it's my load to bear, my burden to bear. What do I do? What do I talk about? Do I talk about everything? And so I said, what I'm going to do, I'm going to write an ode. And I wrote a piece of poetry, an ode to Terrence, about 3 pages long, which I read off in Los Angeles. It's in the podcast. And it's got a lot of, it's very much like you're saying. It has a lot of veiled things, a lot of, you'd have to do the research to understand some of the things. But it actually does tell the story of the whole man in, 2.5 pages or less.
You know what? Unfortunately, we got to end it here. We're at the end of our time. I know we're going to have you back because this was an awesome conversation. People can find out more stuff on Damer.com, my fault, D-A-M-E-R.com. And thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks, Bruce.
You're very welcome.
From Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.